Welcome to
The Supertone Show.
The show is co-hosted by the voice you just heard, belonging to Simon Campbell.
That's me.
And myself, Susie Starlight. We're musicians, songwriters, and we run a vintage residential recording studio in Estevella, Valencia.
We sure do.
Spain. He was the most sought-after sound engineer at the time when the recording industry was exploding in the early 1960s in London. And he's worked with everyone. And when I mean everyone, I mean the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, and some people that you wouldn't actually think that he has worked with, this man has. And he's one of the very few truly great record producers. And they say if you remember the 60s, and you probably weren't there, unless, of course, your name is Glyn Johns.
Thank you.
today with me. The faces. What? Wow.
I know. It's like being slapped in the face with a load of British rock and roll, you know, produced by the mighty Glyn Johns. I love this fucking guy. And, of course, the first time I ever really understood who he was is I saw him as engineer on Led Zeppelin 1. And I thought, and he was and of course later I found out what he'd done, and he's done everything. He's been everywhere. His most notable accomplishment, or some people would say, is this drum miking technique, which I'm going to get out of the way straight away because all the producers and engineers have heard this to death. But using three or perhaps four microphones, he does his drum sound, and that's how he's always done it. And it's very, very rare that he does anything else. One overhead, one just to the right of the floor, Tom. One on the kick drum, occasionally one on the snare, and that's it.
Isn't there a YouTube video with him showing this?
Yes.
And didn't you tell me that people were writing in saying it doesn't
work? It doesn't
work.
Yes, that is absolutely right. And, you know, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
I really can't believe it, because Led Zeppelin 1, which was the precursor of the rock and roll drum sound. Of course, you got Bonzo Bonham playing drums. But holy shit, it sounds like it's a tsunami of rock and roll, you know, that drum sound. But you see, the less mics you've got, the less shit you've got with phase and all the technical stuff, which I don't want to talk about on this podcast. But if your drummer's playing well, and he's hitting the drums evenly and the cymbals evenly and everything, and he's creating a good racket himself that he's listening to, it will sound great with that technique, you know? And even recording a full band, we've done it in the studio here. If you've actually got a drummer that's loud enough, because sometimes if you play very quiet, it's difficult because you do get too much bleed in our particular studio. But, you know, it just works. Anyway, I don't want to go on the drum sound too much, but
enough,
that's it.
Enough drums.
Enough of the drum sound. So, but let's talk about Glyn Johns and the faces. He doesn't do drugs, and I don't think he does alcohol. I think he's teetotal, and he was working with the faces, who are the complete antithesis of this. They were drunken, womanizing monsters from hell, known for it. The greatest pub band in the world, that's what they said. And when you read the book, and we have been reading his excellent book, Sound Man, which I would definitely get a hold of. It really is fantastic. And even if you're not into sound recording as such, and you just want to read something about rock and roll history, the tales in there are tremendous, you know, because it talks a lot about how things came about rather than the actual technical stuff, you know.
Yeah, well, I bought it for you for your birthday a couple of months ago, and you've just finished it, so I'm on page 38 and I'm finding it really interesting.
Yeah, it's so riveting. It is riveting.
It is. And he's got a really nice, easy writing style as well, which is great.
Well, it is, yeah, and it's. But just going back to the faces, just before we move on to the next track, you know, one of his other things is that he records people in the same room. Now, you know, at the same time, and that was his big thing as well. So this drum sound, and in recording people in the same room, and you listen to that track, there's no click there. They were probably all steaming drunk when they did it. You know, you can hear the tempo waving about. But it's beautiful.
It feels alive.
It does. It feels, it moves in and out of the tempo, you know. And those breaks at the end, you know, it's not out of time, but it moves within the whole song. And that's the beauty of it, you know.
Yeah.
And Rod, you can hear him at the end. I don't know whether when he did the vocals later on, because he obviously did the vocals later on. But whether they left some of the original vocal, because when he's at the end there, he's like, where, you know, you can hear him in the background, as everybody else is playing. But splendid band, splendid band, splendid production. And you know, the Faces are one of my favourite bands of all time, really. I've loved them for
years. And I'm starting to like them more and more and more every time I hear them.
Yeah, well, that's good. But of course, this man had a tremendous effect on my career from a long time ago and your bass playing career very recently. Mm-hmm.
cocaine, Eric Clapton.
Now, I believe that Glyn Johns fell out with Eric.
I believe he did.
What happened?
Well, they reconciled because Clapton was playing on a session with Pete Townsend and Ronnie Lane on an album called Rough Mix. Yeah. And they reconciled and started working together again to do Slow Hand, which is Eric's fifth album. But Clapton was saying that he really loved working with Glyn when he made Glyn. Because he really knew how to work with both American and British musicians.
Mm. Well, you know, this whole thing about the difference between British and American musos, from what I can see, that the British were far more out of control from an alcohol and drugs point of view, from what I can gather, because from the Faces, you know, and many of the other people that he used to deal with, you know, they were all small faces. Of course, he started off. Unfortunately, and I've got to say this right now, that on this show, we can only play a very few tracks, and we have played some, we're going to play some pretty famous ones, really, because, you know, they are great examples of his work. But,
yeah,
you know, he's done so much stuff, so much great stuff that we can't include on the show. It is incredible.
Yeah.
But back to Clapton. Apparently they'd just come off the road because we're great lovers of EC was here, the album, and it was done after that. And they'd just come off the road, and it was Carl Radle.
Carl Radle.
Yeah, your.
I love Carl Radle. He's such a brilliant bass player.
Yeah, beautiful. And Jamie Oldacre on drums. And they came off.
They were tight.
Well, they were.
Basically.
Yeah, that's right. Because they were great musicians in their own right. But after just coming off tour with him, and they went straight in the studio, and apparently they laid down Wonderful Tonight, Cocaine, and Lay Down Sally in an afternoon. And they did that before they, you know, it was incredible. So, of course, that would suit Glyn Johns' military precision technique because he hates people jamming in the studio, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Because, well, it was like wasting valuable recording time.
That's what he said, yeah.
That's what Clapton said anyway.
Yeah. Well, we know he's a bit of a disciplinarian because he's thrown pretty many people out of the studio. I mean, as you'll hear later on, you know, he's thrown some of the most famous names in rock out of the studio.
He's not interested in ego, though, is he?
He's
just totally focused on the music. I think that some of the quotes on the back of the books, obviously I haven't read all of it yet, are saying that, you know, he just says it as it is. If you don't listen or he's doing it a certain way and you work with him because he's trying to get the best for your music.
Well, I think he also has a big ego himself. There's no doubt about it. I mean, reading this book, you know, he tells people how it is. But, you know, when you're as famous and as talented as he is, you know, and he is, of course, rather than was, because I made the hideous mistake a couple of years now of actually saying to somebody he was dead. And I'm really sorry, Glyn.
It does happen, though.
Yes.
When you think someone's, like, passed on and you think, oh, no, because you haven't heard of them for a while or whatever, and they're still going, it's like, great!
He's so famous, you expect him to be dead, really, because he's got such a thing that he
released. Especially with this year, the way it started, with everyone dropping off the planet, it's like, what's going on?
Yeah, because the last record I knew he did, and we're going to be playing a track of it later on, was the 2011 record by Ryan Adams.
Yeah.
And I know that, and a good friend.
Ryan Adams?
Yes, not Brian Adams, but Ryan Adams, a very good friend of ours, and now a keyboard player in the UK, and on the records, Christian Madden, said I should listen to this record. And that was something that was very interesting. And I did at the time as well, because I knew he produced it. But anyway, he's not dead. Glyn,
no. We
love you.
And yes, we do love you, Glyn. And Cocaine was like a mega-selling single for Clapton, wasn't it? It's
yeah,
just like,
it was the biggest signed album, Slow Hand, I think.
Written by J.J. Cale as well.
Yeah.
Now, I've got a question here, because it seems to me that Clapton, just as quick aside, did a lot of covers of songs that J.J. Cale wrote.
Mm.
So there's obviously something that J.J. had, but he seemed to have... He was very good at picking up on songs, wasn't he, Clapton, in terms of that kind of...
Yeah, well, another, and we're not name dropping it. We do know this guy, you know, through our friend Monty Hitchcock, and that is a real name as well. Manager, he used to be Emma Lou's manager in Nashville.
Nashville, baby.
The Tulsa Time track and the Tulsa Time incident.
Yeah.
That was an incredible thing, because apparently he heard Tulsa Time in a hotel room and then went down and said he was going to record it, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know? I think it, with a lot of artists, he did that with. But I actually think that he really wanted to be in the band, i.e. the band with Robbie Robertson and everything. He wanted to create a sound like the band. That's what he always did, I think. After he had his rock phase with Cream,
yeah,
and then he did Derek and the Dominoes, of course,
yeah,
and he put a band together that was all, it was like it was merging into that type of thing. You know, he had Duane Album on Layla, he had Steve Winwood, of course, on keyboards, and that whole thing, and it was moving in that, but he never sort of captured, he never managed to get there because of the band of the band, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that after Cream, like the band of the band, do you think Cream was the cream? And after that, I know it sounds like a bit of a pun, but for me, it seemed like that was like the ultimate band for Clapton in terms of being in a band.
Well, it was. Because
he's always kind of done his solo stuff, hasn't he, with collaborations since
right.
then.
After that, that's right. Yeah. I think he, and it was really the only band he was ever in. You know, he played sessions for the Beatles. He played sessions, as we're saying, with Glyn Johns on this Pete Townsend, you know, on Rough Mix, that record, Ronnie Lane.
A friend of mine, by the way, Nick Stevens, had tickets to go and see Cream, and it was the last gig they ever played. But his mum wouldn't let him go because I think he was about 16, because he had his Latin O-level exam the day after. So he wasn't allowed to go and see Cream. They split up. And
did he pass his Latin O-level?
No.
Well, that's a slap in the face indeed, isn't it?
But actually, and that's like Nick's idol in terms of Eric. He's just like, he's got his signature in a frame on the wall. He just absolutely loves Eric Clapton.
Well, I never got to see Led Zeppelin from a similar thing because they were on at, Alexander Palace? In London, and I was going to go down there. Of course, Manchester was quite a hike down there.
Yeah,
and I had trouble with my mother because my mother didn't want me to be in rock and roll at all, you know. And I think I was about the same age, and she wouldn't let me go, you know. So and after that, I never got to see him. I never got to see Led Zeppelin live. Anyway, just one of those things. But Nick,
it's a good job we've got recordings, though. I was thinking about this the other day. You know, we might not be able to get to see everyone live. But the beauty is that these recordings can keep the band with us at that time.
That's right.
That's exactly what these recordings are, you know? Before we had bloody internet and all this kind of social media stuff, we were out there at gigs. And if you couldn't go, you could get the gig in your home, in your space. And it's really important, you know, and that's probably why there was this live aspect, you know?
Well, and that is the importance of the record producer. The record producer capturing that moment in time, the best the band can be at that moment, and mixing it in a way, or choosing the right takes, and actually taking that material and actually representing it in the best way possible. And that is the power of the record producer. We saw Daniel Armoire last time. Mm. He does that. Everybody in the same room, uses the people in the same room, makes sure that the material he produces, the best from that particular band, the best he can get out of them. And suspect Glyn Johns is very similar, in a less French-Canadian way, of course. I think he's more Miss Whiplash as opposed to Daniel Lanois. Anyway, so but Eric Clapton, that was a great track.
So, okay, who have we got next?
Well, I'm not going to tell you.
To let me know, should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know, Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine and next is black. So if you want me off your back, well come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go there will be trouble. Decisions bugging me.
Indecision, they molest us.
If you don't want me, set me free.
Set me careless, you
got me. Exactly whom I'm supposed to be.
Hey,
don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow?
Should I stay or should I go by The Clash? I had a bit of a country accent then. Should I stay?
It's coming back. It's coming back. Now you're not speaking. No, you're not living in England. You say this is the thing. It's called
it's
coming
really
back.
Really weird then.
He hated punk, Glenn Johns. It was a complete, you know, a complete.
But how can you work
new universe?
How would you work with the band then if you didn't like what they were doing or their genre?
His mate, Muff Winwood, now. Don't laugh. Yes. Muff. We have a lot of Muffs in this house. Big Muffs. We got lots of albums by Muff Winwood himself.
Muffin the Mule.
Yeah. And anyway, Muff Winwood. He convinced Glenn Johns to do it because what had happened is that The Clash had delivered this apparent double album to him and it wasn't the way he expected it. So he asked Glenn Johns to remix it or mix it actually. And Glenn decided it only should be a single album, so he cut a load of stuff out, which really upset Mick Jones. And apparently he did a mix of the album, and Mick Jones came in, and he just sat the way through it without moving, didn't like the idea of it at all. Joe Strummer loved the idea of Glenn Jones working on it. Mick Jones didn't. Anyway, Glenn Jones threw him out of the studio. So that's one person he's done at the studio. We'll talk about others
bloody
later
hell.
On. There we are. No messing about. Yeah, he didn't want to. He rang me up with him. He said, "I don't want him to come to the rest of the sessions. He's upset me, and that's it." And this is Glenn Johns. So he's got an ego, you know. But
yeah.
He produced this shit, and it sounds fantastic. And it's the biggest signed record of combat rock. You know, it's a you know. And I'm not a big punk man. I'm not a great big punk aficionado. I know very little about it really, but what I do know. Is what I like, and I like that, you know, and because it's a massive sound, you know, the musicianship's not as accomplished as you would get with Eric, with these American, you know, the Carl Radle and old day Jimmy O'Day, and you know, with this beautiful groove and all that. It's a lot more rough and rock
raw.
And roll and raw.
Yeah,
but it's but he has captured the moment of that, even though he didn't record it. You know, he's definitely done. Something to it.
It's giving it the space, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And what is really funny, though, I listened to it, and it must have been... I haven't heard it on any of his other recordings, but he uses a great big fat reverb on the snare drum. It goes boom, boom. If you listen back to it, now you can. It's a podcast. You can just rewind, listen back to the track. He's got a big fucking snare reverb on there, which is funny. And he's captured or managed to mix the song to, you know, to something that is really beautiful. You know.
So the one thing I do, just talking about those innovations in terms of, like, you've got the reverb on the snare. So part of this, the whole sort of producing and engineering phase, especially while it's still going on, it's been going on all the time, is to try and work out innovative ways of making sounds better. And I mean, obviously this was more cutting through, wasn't it? Or
yeah,
some effect.
But it's enhancing or trying to make the song and the music just more listenable or more appealing or just more beautiful, because, you know, the producer and the engineer's art is just as important as the musician's. Mm. The musician's got to create it, yeah. And that's, you know, if you've got shit, you can't polish shit. It's there, shit.
Shit.
Chris Hill, my mate who used to run a company called Wigwam Acoustics, a great big PA company in the UK, who I worked with on many, many occasions, great guy. Chris, big man, big beard, big man, big personality. And I always remember I was at the mixing console once, and there was this support band to Chris Rea on, and it sounded fucking awful. And I thought, holy shit, this gig is going to be awful, you know? It really is, you know? They had this huge Meyer system in there. It was an arena. I think it was the NEC. I can't remember. It was so massive. And it sounded like shit. And then Chris Rea came on, and all of a sudden it sounded fantastic, you know? And I said, Chris, I said, as the engineer, did you just purposely change the mix to make the support band sound bad? He said, listen, lad, he said, you put shit in, he said, you get shit in but louder. Shit out but louder, which I've always thought about. So if you stick a mic in front of it in a studio or live, and you stick a mic in front of it, if it sounds shit, it's going to sound shit through a console. And when you put it to tape, no matter what you do with it, it's still shit.
Yeah.
If it's beautiful, if you've got Jamie Oldacre tapping those hi-hats and Carl Radle, you know, plucking that bass, or these guys, you know, Strummer and Mick Jones and all those guys, you know, they're creating a noise which is a good noise, and it's appropriate for the song, and that's the skill of the producer.
And the thing is though, you need like a different pair of ears, don't you, to look objectively, listen objectively, because as the artist, you can get too involved. And at the end of the day, it is a product. You're emotionally and creatively involved with it, but you need to be able to step away from it and look at it in a different way. And sometimes you can't do it. You've got to have a fresh set of ears.
Totally. And that's the thing. I think that's the thing about a producer, and that is why, I mean, Glyn Johns is a musician. He started off. He had his own band, didn't he? And he made himself a
T-chess bass.
Yeah, he thought he was going to be a star. He really got into it, and then his engineering production took over. But he wasn't. You know, he was a musician to start off with, and that's really important. I think Lamoire's a musician. I think, you know, it's unusual that you get a great producer that's not a musician, like George Martin, who we're going to be doing in a couple of weeks, I think.
Mm.
You know, he was a fantastic musician himself. So I think you've got to be a musician to be a producer, in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah. Okay, let's have another song.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy. She'll beat you if she's able. You know the queen of hearts. always your best bet. Now it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon your table, but you only want the ones that you can't get. Desperado, oh, you ain't getting no young. Your pain and your hunger, they're driving you home. And freedom, oh, freedom, well, that's just some people talking. Your prison is walking through this world all alone. Don't your feet get cold in the wintertime? The sky won't snow and the sun won't shine. It's hard to tell the nighttime from the day. It may be raining, but there's a rainbow above you. You better let somebody love you.
Let somebody love you.
You better let somebody love you before it's too.
Desperado, the Eagles.
Now you can understand why he didn't like punk. And, of course, the Eagles, fine American musicians, fantastic harmonies, very accomplished in songwriting, very accomplished in playing. Apparently, Glenn, the late, great Glenn Frey, who died, of course, earlier this year in January, he played a piano on that. And it's just a fantastic song. Never released as a single, that, you know?
Really?
No. Linda Ronstadt released it as a single, and it was massive, but it never... But, of course, they're laughing all the way back to the Wells Fargo, aren't they, you know, with that badger? Because, I mean, they, you know...
yeah.
That must have made him a lot of money. But, you know, the harm. But he worked with the Eagles after... much gnashing of teeth at Glenn Johns, because he went to see him the first time and apparently they were playing covers and he didn't want to do it. And the head of the record company said, well, you know, you need to listen to the fantastic. He went to see him, didn't like him. They convinced him to go see him again and apparently just broke into harmonies with one of the first songs. I can't remember which one it was. And he said, holy shit, yeah, I've got to record him now. And he did. And that was one of the results of his efforts. And I mean, it's you compare that with the Faces, the Clash, Eric Clapton, and now we've got this. These are very, very different records, very, very different artists.
Mm.
But he's, you know, but each song has he's brought out the very, very best, I think, in the song and the musicians.
Well, I read that Glenn was trying to keep the Eagles within their budget as well. He was actually mindful of time. A disciplinarian, would you believe?
Yes.
Right, so when they recorded this track, it was the London Philharmonic Orchestra that they were playing with, and Glenn had only 3 takes because of the fees. So he had 3 tries at it, and that was it.
On piano?
No, with the actual orchestra.
Oh,
it was
right.
Recorded with the orchestra together.
Holy shit.
So he only had 3 takes. And if you know anything about the Eagles, they're kind of perfectionists. They grew into more and more perfectionism, where everything had to be right, and they'd take years for their later albums to come out, because it's very, very, it had to be spot on or whatever. And he was saying, he said it's flawed, but, you know, like humans are, I think he had to live with it. I think if he had had his choice, he would have done it 20 times.
Well,
but there's something magical in that take.
But that's what Glyn Johns is all about. You see, he's not into the Steely Dan and later Eagles way of doing things.
No.
He wants it done then and there, and creating the best out of the musicians at the time at that early stage of the recording. You know, because you know, I love Steely Dan and I love, you know, Donald Fagen, The Nightfly. It's still one of my, you know, it's in my top 20 albums. You know, it's a great record, beautifully produced. But it is so detailed. It's so absolutely pin sharp in every respect, from the production to the playing and everything else. But, but you know, I think it took a long time to do.
Do you know my story about the Eagles?
Mm.
I was, I guess I was in my early 30s, and I stopped writing for a year or two, thinking that I was too old, would you believe? And I just thought, oh, no, it's a young person's game. And I was working late at night, and I managed to get a ticket to go and see them. Front row, NEC.
Mm.
No, actually, it was the MEN. Sorry,
MEN Arena.
Yeah, no, NEC.
That's Manchester,
yeah.
Manchester, England.
Manchester Arena. So I walk up on my own. I went on my own, walked straight to the front, and I'm sat there with all these people I didn't know. So I thought, I'm going to say hello, because I wanted to know why they were all there as well. And they found out that they were all got last-minute tickets, so all like single tickets. And then the Eagles came on, and I looked at them. I thought, oh, my God, this is just like a lunchtime concert at college. It's like these guys are just like normal people. They play beautifully. And they're like, they were like 20, 30 years older than me. And I thought, shit, why have I stopped?
Yeah.
You know, seriously, because when you... There's this whole media thing and this whole hype that goes on, and you've got to be a certain way. And I just thought, you know what? I've got like more of a folk background anyway, and I just thought that this is ridiculous. What was I even thinking? And you can get distracted by life and other things. And I just thought, no, I'm not going to allow that to enter my head ever again. And I never have.
Well, you couldn't have seen a better band, because, I mean, live, they really are fucking good, you know. And I think, you know, it probably was counterproductive in the later records to actually work too much on it, because they were good enough to do it. They were good enough to go in a studio and do it, you know.
There was this song, I said, there was this ballad, and I didn't realise that I knew so many Eagles songs. I just thought I knew a couple, really. And do you know what? I knew every single one. And I said to this person on my right, she said, oh, no, I love this ballad called I Can't Tell You Why, but, you know, it's not well known, I won't play it. Anyway, three songs in, the lights go down. And the spotlight, and they go, dum, 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 dum. Right in front of me is Tim B. Schmidt on bass, who sings lead on that song.
Bass?
Oh, yeah, well, I didn't even know about the bass at that point, right? So I just saw him in front of me, and he started, and that song melts me every time. Do you know what? I cried. I just sat there, and I had my hands over my mouth, and I just couldn't believe that they were playing this such a beautiful song that I used to sing all the time. And it was there, and I think it was one of the most amazing, for me, quite a beautiful experience to be there, not expecting it. And Tim B. Schmidt's got a beautiful voice. Mm. And it was, and the whole song is just so beautiful. So, yeah, that for me was one of my moments.
Yeah, well.
At a gig.
Great, you know.
Yeah.
Great band. And that track, great, you know, and great production.
And they're not
themselves
to everybody's taste, you know. But the thing is that I love their harmonies. And, we're big harmony people. And I've always been into harmonies. And they're beautiful songs. And I, you know, there's room for everyone on the planet.
Absolutely. Including this man.
Get a maid find a place nearby for her to stay. Just someone to keep my house clean, fix my meals and go away. A
Man Needs a Maid, Neil Young.
Amazing. From one of our favourite albums, from one of our favourite artists. But he didn't produce this, did he?
No, he engineered this. He was in the Rolling Stones truck.
Yeah, the truck, Rolling Stones. The reason why I always go Rolling Stones truck mobile is that on Smoke on the Water, the vocal, he gets it the wrong way around. Ian Gillan says it the wrong way around because, of course, they used the Rolling Stones truck to record, the album.
Yeah.
And with Smoke on the Water and High West Down, all his famous records. But the Rolling Truck Stones thing just outside, that's what he sings. So I can never sing it right. Say it right. Anyway, that's an aside. Nothing to do with the Deep Purple here. We're actually backing Glyn Johns. And
so there he is, rolling up with the Rolling Stones, the Stones of the Rolling Truck.
Yeah.
At Barking Town Hall.
Barking mad.
With the London Symphony Orchestra again.
Yeah.
And they started work at 10 o'clock.
Incredible.
And that's, I think, I mean, that's fantastic. So you've got Neil Young and a piano and the London Symphony.
Mm.
With a bigger budget, obviously. I think he probably had more takes than the Eagles to do when they were first starting out. But there's, can I tell you this little story about the...
Was conductor or something?
Yeah, I was reading about this. The American producer, Jack Nitzsch.
Jack Nicholson?
No.
Okay.
It's Nitzsche.
Nitzsche. Okay. Right.
Was started off conducting the orchestra, but he hadn't got a clue. And it was like by the end of the first take, it was all over the place. And Glyn was in the mobile truck. And anyway, one of the second fiddle players put their hands up and went up and talked to him. So he ran out of the truck thinking, oh, God, you know, I'm going to have to try and intervene here in case they fall out. And this second fiddle guy said, look, you know, I'm an experienced conductor. Would you mind if I actually conduct? And he said, yeah, no problem, and just stepped aside. So Glyn thought it was going to be a big kickoff, and it wasn't. And it went all smoothly. Fantastic.
Well, that's amazing. That's a great story. That's and a great rock and roll story, because that shows improvisation. Like, can you imagine paying all those boys to rock up, hire the town hall, the Stones Mobile, Glyn Johns, who won't be, you know, he's not going to do it for a pint, is he? You know, that sort of thing.
Might have a pie as well.
It's amazing. Fantastic.
Yeah.
What I do love about that track is the sensitivity of the engineering, because that sounds like a proper piano in a proper hall. It does not sound like something processed. It's not over bright. It's a dark sound. Obviously, he did the vocal at the same time, you know, and we can tell it's at the same time. It's got that intensity about it, you know.
Mm.
And he was a master. And of course, he loved that mobile truck, because it had the Helios desking, which is the same as when it was Olympic.
Yeah.
And of course, we went to the studio in Nashville where he did the rest of it, didn't he?
Yeah.
Didn't we? Quadraphonic Studios in Nashville. We actually walked into the room and
in the very room.
Yeah, where a lot of that was recorded.
And it was just wood.
It
I
was.
I just remember loads of wood. It was like a log cabin, like a sauna.
It was like a
It was, wasn't it?
He felt like walking. They're from Sweden, and it's like a sauna without plenty of.
I kind of stood there waiting for a holy kind of moment, you know. It didn't happen.
No.
Because it's funny when you kind of go, oh, yeah, so and so did this here. But unless they're there, it doesn't, you know, I didn't really.
Yeah, it didn't do it, did it? You know,
no,
it,
I don't. Not for me, not for that one.
Anyway. Back to Glyn Johns.
Yes, Glyn.
Great recording of
well
of,
done, man.
Of Neil Young, one of our favourite tracks. So, yeah, well done, man. Who the fuck do you think you are? You know? Do you know this man?
I don't remember when we wild and young. All that's faded in the I feel like somebody I don't know. Are we really who we used to be? Am I really who I was? Well, the lights will draw you in, and the dark will bring you down, and the night will break your heart, but only if you're lucky now. Waiting outside while you find your keys, like bags of trash in the blackening snow. City of neon and toes that freeze. We got nothing and nowhere to go. We got nothing and nowhere. And the lights will draw you in, and the dark will take you down. The lights draw you in, and the dark can take you down. Then love can mend your heart, but only if you're lucky now. soul that's faded into memory. I feel like somebody I don't know. Are we really who we used to be? Am I really who I was?
Ryan Adams, Lucky Now.
From Ashes and Fire.
Sounds quite fierce.
Ashes and Fire. Yeah.
I don't really know anything about Ryan Adams.
Well, he's one of these old country dudes, you know.
Mm.
And to me, he just sounds like Jackson Browne, which is, of course, it's certainly a compliment from me. I'm not sure he'd take it as a compliment, but it is from me. Wonderful production.
I was going to say, the space.
Mm. Great vocal sound. But again, you know, reading the book, he was using exactly the same technique. And when he did this in 2011, he'd had a bit of a hiatus at Lynn Johns because he felt that his production and the way he was running things was old-fashioned and outdated. And what he did, he got other engineers in later on to actually help him to sort of change to a more modern sound. But then he came back to production really with this album. He'd done bits and bats of of people who he'd worked with before.
Yeah,
Linda Ronstadt and all those sort of carry on. But this was his resurgence back into popular music production. You know, and I think he's done a magnificent job. I love that. This is the only single from the album. But again, it was, you know, Billboard top 10. It actually made it to the, you know, the top 10 in the UK charts as well, which for an old country thing is quite difficult, really.
But for me, that track feels alive. There's something magical about it. And that was the first time I'd heard that song as well. So,
is that right?
Oh, yeah. So, and I'm really, you know, there's nothing wrong with not knowing about someone. There's nothing wrong.
Absolutely not. Well, no, there's so many artists.
Exactly,
about that,
and the whole joy is about discovering people. You know,
and
it's
doing
not
this
like
podcast is really good for it, isn't it? It's really cool,
it is because I'm learning so much, and I'm happy to say when I don't know, because we will have learned this information at some point. We weren't all born with this knowledge, and it's no big race, and I don't have to wear it as a medal going, well, I learned that in January 1764.
Well, you're not as old as that, darling.
No, you don't want to be, though.
Of course, but on this album as well is Ben Montench, who? Ben Montench. He is the keyboard player out of Tom Petty's and Heartbreakers.
Right, okay.
So it's all that sort of American stuff. So and Glyn Johns produced his solo album, Ben Montench's solo album, later on, last few years, I think.
I'll tell you what it is as well, is that when it comes to that style of music, I prefer to be in the room and actually see people live, because I like to, for me, it's like an ambience thing. It's the crowd, it's the artists in the flesh, that's when I really love that style of music. But that is like one of the first tracks I've heard in a long time that makes me feel like I'm with them.
Yeah, it's a magnificent recording.
Yeah.
But the reason why I heard it some years ago is that a big friend of ours and keyboard player of ours in the UK who's played on both albums and who works with us a lot, a guy called Christian Madden, great Hammond player,
great musician.
You know, all-round musician. But he said, you need to check it out, man. He said, you need to check this Ryan Adams guy out, you know. And I probably said, if you like it, Christian, it's going to be shit, so I'm not going to listen to it. That's what
that's
I probably
said
to him.
Said
that's
to him, yeah.
Exactly. And he'll go, fuck you. And that'll be it. Because, you know, he's from Burnley. I'm from sort of Bury. So it's, you know.
Let's go for a pint.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Let's have a fight, and then we'll have a pint, or a pint, and then a fight, and then a curry. Anyway, yeah, so Ryan Adams, beautiful.
Well, I think that's fantastic as well, that, you know. It's weird, though, isn't it, when you think you... That with Glyn Johns thinking that his style's got, and maybe, you know, if you focus on, like, even now, if you look at different genres and you've got electronic bands coming out and synth based, you know, obviously that kind of style, there's no one live in the room to record anyway, you know.
Well, the reason that I was alluding before about the all this studio construction and all that sort of carry on is that he said that the death, now, this is going to upset a lot of people. It's going to upset a lot of people all over the world. But he said the death of music recording came with the advent of the SSL mixing console and the over design of production studio rooms. He loved just rocking up, and he loved Olympic Studios. He worked in there an awful lot, but it's a barn of a place, you know, fucking great. I mean, I would love to have a place with a live room as big as that. It's beautiful, you know. But he'd do it anywhere. He'd just rock up and he'd take his console and stick it in a back room somewhere and then just record somebody and then go and mix it. Because he was more interested in the space, he was more interested in capturing the music in situ and just adapting a space to... And I think a lot of this is lost now, you know? That's what we've done here. I'm not saying I'm Glyn Johns, mate. You know, I'm not even a pimple on his arse. You know, I mean, Glyn Johns. But it's but what we've done here is that we've done something similar. We've taken an existing structure. We haven't done really anything to it. Just deadened it a little bit and made it. But you know, but we're creating great music here, or people are creating great music, and we're recording great music here. You know.
Yeah, I think for me personally as well, as I wanted to go into a creative space with light and dark if I wanted it, you know, the option of having that. But to have character, to be in a part of something and not going into this sterilised kind of laboratory.
Yeah.
Because that for me isn't good. I didn't enjoy it.
Absolutely. Incidentally, if you're hearing banging of microphone stands, both our Labradors in here, the girls, as we call them, Hummock and Bob. It was Hummock's birthday yesterday.
They
had sausages. So they're in here and they're just bumping the mic. So we can't help that. That's it. It's just rock and roll.
Open
man.
Door policy here.
It's only rock and roll, but we like it.
Rock.
And talking of rock and roll.
I know I'm never gonna leave you, babe. I gotta go away from this place.
Babe, I'm going to leave you. Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
Babe, I'm going to leave you. Led Zeppelin.
Whap out the lead. Well, these shows seem to have a lot of Led Zeppelin.
That's a good thing.
Well, it can never be bad.
It's like vitamin C, vitamin D, B12.
And lots of fish oil.
Omega-3, magnesium.
It's fantastic. What an amazing album Led Zeppelin was, one of the I don't want to go on about it because over the past shows I've talked about Led Zeppelin an awful lot.
I love that though, you know.
But it's just incredible. It was produced, recorded and mixed in 36 hours over the period of a few weeks because Peter Grant, the manager, the fifth member and the very, very mean and who defined rock and roll management, Peter Grant and Jimmy Page paid for it themselves. So those two paid for themselves. And Jimmy Page said he knew what he wanted to do, that arranged a lot of the material because they'd been on a Scandinavian tour. Again, if you've listened to our other podcast, I'm probably repeating myself, but I apologise. I'm very passionate. I love this stuff. Because the Yardbirds split up. So they took the space on the tour, Jimmy Page, and did the tour instead of the Yardbirds. And they arranged it on the road. They came in, 36 hours to record Led Zeppelin. Glyn Johns, it's the shortest paragraph in the book because he didn't produce this. It was produced by Jimmy Page. And he said all he did, he put mics around everything. He put the faders up and pressed the record button, and that was it. And it's the shortest chapter, and you read it in the whole book. Incredible. He said because he knew exactly what they were doing. He'd used Jimmy Page as a session musician over many occasions.
Yeah.
And what I love about that track is the fact that, I don't know, 1.5 minutes in or so, you can hear the original guide vocal.
I can hear it calling me.
Yeah. You can hear the original guide vocal of Robert Plant with, gone into the drum mics, nothing that you could do about it. And, of course, when he put the main vocal on afterwards, it's still in there, but you can't get rid of it out of the drum mics. But that's fantastic. What a fantastic thing.
He left it in. It sounded like an echo, though. It was beautiful.
A reverse echo, that's right.
Yeah.
And, I never knew how he did it, but it was completely unintentional. Now, that's proper shit, you know?
Yeah.
Again, done in Olympic Studios, but, of course, you know, Glyn Johns was just starting off then. He was only, you know, was a mere engineer, you know, just pushing the faders. But anyway... babe, I'm going to leave you. I think the other thing he said, that was the girls shaking the ears, incidentally. You probably heard a bit of ear action there. He said that when they were mixing it, what he did, he just put a bit of reverb on and a bit of echo. That was his contribution to Led Zeppelin. Apart, of course, from the magnificent drum sound and the miking up.
Yeah.
You would never use a Glyn Johns mic technique on those drums in that situation. He's smashing the fuck out of the cymbals. It's psh, it's going like, he's going mad. And there's a lot, you know, you listen to it, you think there was too many cymbals in there, but it was too late because he'd actually recorded it. They only had 36 hours, he fucking recorded it, that was it. But it adds to the fury of the song.
Yeah.
You know, because he didn't choose to mix them that high. He didn't choose for the drum sound to be sort of like that. It was just there because that's what they did. You know, they recorded it. But right, okay, babe, I'm going to leave you. 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3 takes. That's it. It's done. We'll do the guitar solo a bit later on the vocals. Right, next. And that's it. You know? So that's what they did. But it's created an iconic sound and a beautiful sound. And that is what's wrong with today's recordings, that people don't leave shit in. They try and get it perfect.
Sterilise it. That reminds me of the Barbara Streisand thing when that guy edited out all her breathing. It's the same sort of thing. I don't know what happened. We kind of got Howard Hughes about music and everything had to be clean and just sort of like perfect.
Totally. And, you know, that's right. Shall we tell the story about the Barbara Streisand?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we might as well. A young engineer in America, I don't know who it was, but he was on the Barbara Streisand session. And one night, after everybody had gone, he thought it'd be a good idea if he cleaned up the vocal track and went through and cleaned up all the breaths of Barbara Streisand. So he removed all the breathiness from her voice, and all that sort of stuff. She came in next day and listened to it, and she said, "What have you done to my vocal?" And he said, "Well, I've just cleaned it up a bit." And then she said, "You will never work in this town again." And he never did.
No.
Barbara Streisand. So you don't fuck about with Barbara.
No. Don't fuck around with the music too much, really.
Exactly. Really. Yeah. And that was on tape as well. I bet he was erasing the bits. Anyway, we're not going to do that. We're going to carry on.
Indeed. So, I mean, it's fascinating me thinking about Glyn Johns, who didn't drink... Nope. In the studio, because obviously we don't know.
He drank
coffee, that was it. So that's it. He was head down, focused on the music. So he's worked with Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. And all these amazing people.
And all these kind of rockers.
Well, that's it. Now, just imagine what it was like in the studio with the Aura Blue.
Thank you.
get fooled again. The Who.
Yeah.
Wow.
I know. It's incredible. I mean, I've got to tell you the story about this. I want to see him. I can't, it was the NEC or somewhere. Unfortunately, Keith Moon had died. It was Kenny Jones on drums. Kenny Jones used to play with the Faces, so that we heard him earlier on, you know. And he wasn't Keith Moon. It wasn't fair, because nobody could be Keith Moon, you know, to do all that shit.
Yeah.
But John Entwistle, the bass player, and I know you like bass.
See.
He never liked going to the PA. He thought the PA was for, like, Jesse's really and all that sort of stuff. He didn't like doing it. So his on stage volume was ferocious. And I remember he had a wall, but not like a wall of amps like they have now, where like two of them are actually working and plugged in and actually just for effect. These were all on. And it was Sun Coliseum, and you know our friend Chris Taylor, who's a resident engineer at the studio here. Chris and Sun O, the band Sun O.
Yeah.
Using Sun Coliseum amps, right? So yeah, this big wall of Sun amps. And when they came in with this, when after that, all that ham at the Hammond, which is a synthesized Hammond. And when he came in with that bass note, boom, but I'm not kidding, my internal organs rearranged. The fearsome volume, it was unbelievable. And I must have been about 25, 30 rows back. And I'm not kidding. It virtually made me feel sick of the power, because he obviously turned everything on full shred and he had a real trebly sound, but the amount of power, my God. It's hardly surprising, you know, old Pete Townsend lost his hearing because, you know, he's had a real problem with his hearing because of the volume.
Oh, but I'll tell you what, the pleasure of playing that note, though. My God, man.
Anyway, back to The Who and Glenn Johns. So it's right that they tried to record this twice, didn't they, before they brought Glenn Johns in as producer? Because they'd obviously worked with him before.
Yeah, because I think Pete was really... He wrote it and got the demo. I think he was going to write a rock opera. I think this was towards... he had an idea for a multimedia film. Was it Lifehouse?
Yeah.
And because he'd studied an Indian sort of religious avatar character. Well, I can't remember... Boomer Rama or Rama Boomer or somebody, and he was writing this rock opera. It's about, I think he wanted to sort of express, from what I understand, the collaboration between the audience and the band, and something about this perfect chord or something. So anyway, that got sidelined, but he'd come to the table already experimenting with all these different synths and stuff. He just got them and learned how to use them, and then came with these demos.
Yeah, because the Hammond, because that was a synthesized Hammond, or Hammond processed anyway. And now, can you imagine doing that in the early 70s? No click track. So Keith Moon had to listen to this on cans when he was playing. When they did it live, they did exactly the same thing. It was just played, you know? Or recorded and played back. I don't know what they used to do live in terms of the actual Hammond itself, because it's like it's quite a metronomic part, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, it, incredible.
And so Glyn was brought in, wasn't he?
He was brought in to rescue the session from one of the biggest rock bands in the world. It was only a few years before that they actually headlined Woodstock on the Saturday night. You know, so they came out with this badger and they brought Glyn Johns into Britain. And of course, it ended up again being one of the biggest albums that they ever did. And that song is, you know, hell of a thing. The drums and the snare. I love the snare because at the beginning, when it fires up, the drums don't sound very sort of very powerful. And now, again, you'd want to make them more powerful and bigger in the mix and really bring them forward. But they were just back. And then the rest of the fucking instruments come in, the bass, and it's that big cranky. I'm very excited into that because I love that. You know?
Yeah.
Gretsch through a Bandmaster sounds fantastic. Crunch, whang, wong, wong, you know. Tremendous.
So you've got this... So at this point in the podcast, I've got this image of... a serious Glyn Johns, who actually inside is a rock and roll fiend, as well as a gentle orchestral person.
Yeah,
no, he's got a wide landscape, a soundscape, hasn't he? Really, but isn't it interesting?
Well, dealing with Keith Moon, who was an alcohol crazed, lunatic of rock, because he was one of the rock's biggest exponents of abuse, you know, of all substances, of life, really. He abused everything. Mm. He was a great drummer and very much a part of that sound, you know, and they couldn't have done it without him.
It seems like Glyn just tended to, from what I gather, look, it sounds like he just focused on the job in hand, really.
Yeah.
And, like, didn't look at the peripheries.
Well,
didn't get engaged with all that shit and just dealt with the shit.
Well, he would certainly have to deal with the shit with the horrible ooh, you know. So there we have it. That is our appreciation.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, you know, I would urge you to get the book, Sandman, by Glyn Johns. Very fine read for anybody who's interested in rock and roll music and anybody who's interested in engineering and production. It's an essential read. You know?
And his son Ethan as well is a musician and recording and producing and engineering.
Well, you know something? I actually think we should do a different program on Ethan Jones, yeah, because he's done a lot of great stuff, and I think it would be sad for us to sort of tie him in with Glyn because of course it's his brother Andy as well, because Andy Johns, his younger brother who went into production, did all
they
the
sound
rest.
Like the Bee Gees.
Well, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, because Andy, who sadly died a few years ago, he did all the later Led Zeppelin albums. Because he did, and everybody thinks it was Glyn, but it wasn't, it was Andy. Andy did the most famous drum sound of all time. And that is When the Levee Breaks off Led Zeppelin 4. And that's him. Again, with the, I think it was the Rolling Stones struck again. But it was...
But today...
Yeah, today it's Glyn.
Glyn Johns, this is your life.
Anyway.
A tiny page. Anyway, yeah, it's been a real eye-opener. I love learning about people and what they've been up to and finding out about new artists and... people that have been around that I just haven't sort of had any time for, you know, hadn't listened to before. It's fantastic.
Indeed. Well, I hope you're enjoying this producer series. We're going to be in a few more, and then we're going to get back to our regular feature of getting guests in, I think.
Yeah, and if you've got any suggestions or any feedback, just send us an email. It's podcast@supertonerecords.com.
Yeah.
And we'd love to hear from you.
Twitter, Susie and Simon, all one word, on Twitter.
See.
And then, of course, we have the podcast on the Supertone website now.
See. Oh, yeah, we got a spanky brand new website. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's supertonerecords.com, and it's the Supertone Show. The Supertone Show. All one word in the thing. So.
Okay.
Great. So we'll see you next time.
Okay. Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.